Well, it's good to be back here, and very pleasant weather. Here it's uncomfortably hot in New York State, where I usually come from. I'm going to talk about a topic which in which there's been a lot of recent progress, which I've had difficulty keeping up with, although I try to get these people to do it. Now I'm trying to keep up with it and understand it all. If you ask some hard questions, I may refer them to Debbie, who understands part of it better than I do. This part of the credits has to do with the fact that one of our discussions took place in the Northampton, Massachusetts Ford dealership while we were waiting for my car to get fixed. And all these other people in the waiting room were trying to read their People magazine and their car magazines and so on, and they were hearing just more than they wanted to about entanglement and positive operators. Well, I'm old enough to have, not old enough to have been a 19th century utopian, but I've lived through a number of revolutions, or purported revolutions, and they often didn't produce as much as people had hoped. And one of the ones that had a resurgence in my youth was the notion of free love, which actually was, perhaps it started much earlier, but some of the same people that started the utopian movement were wished to abolish marriage in order to make everything better. And then, of course, along with that came free LSD. And then just, this kind of hope springs eternal in young people and even some old people. I saw that, according to Aram Harrow, maybe free entanglement will change the world. I still believe that. And maybe if it won't change the world, at least it will simplify the theory of quantum channel capacity, which is in a pretty ugly state, I must say. I will speak about these topics here, the problem of the many capacities of quantum channels, something that partly resolves that difficulty, the quantum reverse Shannon theorem, which isn't quite proved in all generality, the classical reverse Shannon theorem, which I understand much better, then something that's a little related to that, which is oblivious remote state preparation. If I have time, I'll talk about something really fun, which is quantum simulated time travel. I guess you all heard my talk about that next week. Here's the problem with the channel capacity, is that there's only one kind of noiseless channel, but a channel can be noisy in a lot of different ways, and as you add noise to it, it gets worse in a series, usually a series of steps of getting worse. I wonder what's happened to we'll see if we need to reformat the screen in order to make these things all show. as you make a channel, what? Oh, I don't care about that. I'm just worrying about the fact that it just hangs off the edge of the screen.
Oh,
yeah. we'll see if it how bad it is. Anyway, as you make a channel noisier, it loses eventually its capacity to carry quantum information directly by way of quantum error correcting codes. It loses its quantum capacity unless you supplement it with back communication. It could be classical back communication. And then we have a larger region of noise where it will still be capable of carrying quantum information. for example, by distributing entanglement and then distilling it and then teleporting. And then we get to a region farther out in which it lacks any classical capacity, but any quantum capacity, but its classical capacity is still enhanced by entanglement. And then finally we get out to this fully classical area in which there's no quantum capacity, and the giving entanglement doesn't help the classical capacity. We thought this was a very boring area, but then Peter found a kind of channel in which it has a kind of hidden quantum capacity. You can send quantum information through it even though entanglement doesn't increase the classical capacity of the channel. You just have to know which part of the input Hilbert space to use for that purpose. So this is a pretty messy diagram, and probably there's messy things we haven't discovered yet about it. And of these capacities, there are several more capacities, but the simplest ones are the plain quantum capacity I talked about, the plain classical capacity. These are all defined in the usual asymptotic way, in the limit of a large block size, the number of bits that you can faithfully transmit per channel use. This is the entanglement-assisted quantum capacity, and this is the classically assisted quantum capacity, and this is the entanglement-assisted classical capacity. Now, these capacities, in addition to there being a lot of them, most of them are not well understood. They have no simple mathematical expression, except for this one here, which has a simple expression analogous to a classical channel's capacity. So I'm going to argue that the entanglement-assisted capacity, even though it conceptually looks like a complicated idea, is really the simplest notion and the one that is the natural generalization of capacity of classical channels. Well, the classical channel capacity is, as Shannon showed, given by a simple expression, which is if you maximize over input distributions, the mutual input-output information, that is the entropy of the input plus the entropy of the output minus their joint entropy, then you get one expression for the classical capacity, which is equal to the classical capacity you get by going to the limit of large block size and asking how fast you can send information through the channel with arbitrarily little error. So I said the same thing here as I wrote on the screen. This would seem to make it clear that classical channels, there's only one interesting asymptotic property of them, which is their capacity. But actually, this is not quite demonstrated, because the classical capacity is just the channel's efficiency for simulating a noiseless channel. But what if you wanted to simulate a noisy channel? Now, apparently, that's such a useless idea that nobody thought of it for all these years. It's like asking about the efficiency of water salination, the art of producing salty water by combining salt and fresh water. What's the most efficient way you can do that? Well, nobody studied that much in engineering, although it might be an interesting question in thermodynamics. Well, I'll get back to that in a little later, but let's now look at the definition of the entanglement-assisted capacity of a quantum channel. Now, here is our noisy quantum channel, and we're going to allow entanglement shared beforehand between the sender and the receiver. And it turns out, no matter how you use this entanglement, the capacity is given by this rather simple expression. That is I'm using S for von Neumann entropy. The entropy of the output is here, the entropy of the output, plus the entropy of the input, Now you'd like to say minus their joint entropy, but the joint entropy of the input and output of a quantum channel is a rather dubious, ontologically dubious concept, because the input and output are not there at the same time, and you can't make an extra copy of the input. But we are saved by the fact that we can imagine the input to be coming from part of an entangled state, and we just keep the other part around without sending it through the channel. And now this joint state of the reference system and this the system that's been through the noisy channel that used to be perfectly entangled with it, that will stand as our surrogate for the joint combination of input and output. In a sense, this is a copy of what the input used to be. So in that case, if we take the same expression, except we're using von Neumann entropies, then we get the expression for entanglement-assisted capacity. Now I'm going to go back to this question of simulating a noisy channel. The reason I became interested in this this reverse Shannon theorem is that you would like to think that all channels become equivalent. It would make things very simple if all quantum channels became equivalent if you flooded the world with free entanglement. That is, they would have only one property about them, a capacity, and you could use one channel to simulate another at an efficiency given by the ratio of the two capacities, these being entanglement-assisted capacities. Well, in order to make that program work, you need not only to be able to simulate a noiseless channel by a noisy one, but you also need to be able to simulate a noisy channel by a noiseless one. So that it became worthwhile to ask what the efficiency of that would be. And so what I mean by this simulation is, suppose we have a sequence of inputs to the quantum channel. We want to do some operation on the sending end, and we've got the assistance of entanglement, that reduces the amount of classical communication that we have to send forward from the sender to the receiver, such that in the limit of large block size, you get a good approximation to the channel output. Now, it's before, I should say this is now known to hold for a great many special classes of channels. It holds for Bell diagonal channels and CQ channels, and for now we know that through this recent work, which I'll sketch, for all channels that have their inputs drawn from a fixed distribution. So I'm choosing those input sequences, those input states from some distribution that's arbitrary and remains fixed, rather than a maliciously chosen sequence of inputs, maliciously chosen in order to expose the flaws in the simulation algorithm. But let's look first at the classical reverse Shannon theorem. Now, so this is the great discovery of Shannon, that a noisy channel can simulate a noiseless one. Now, when I explained this problem to Homer Simpson and said, well, what about the reverse of that? Is there a way for a noiseless channel to simulate a noisy one? He said right away, without really giving much thought to it, you can do that. Yes, of course, quite easily. You just take the input and you put it into Alice's laboratory, and then she adds noise to it and gives it to Bob through the noiseless channel. So this is a simulation that works. I said, well, that's not really quite what I meant. If the channel has a capacity of 2/3, it means that I can send two reliable bits or 200 reliable bits through 300 noisy channel uses. And what I would like to do under those circumstances is to send 300 noisy bits, or simulate the sending of 300 of them through only 200 noiseless bits. And I'll have to use some other resource, because this is not going to give me enough randomness at the output, some common shared random information between the sender and the receiver. Now, so this is the classical reverse Shannon theorem, and it turns out to be true. It's not particularly difficult to prove. In fact, roughly the way you do it is this is considering that you're just doing it with bit strings, and that the channel we're trying to simulate is a binary symmetric channel. So this means that if I have an input string X, it'll get mapped into some fuzzy ball of possible output strings. Well, what I do before I receive my input is to agree between Alice and Bob on a random sprinkling of 2 to the nc plus a little more n-bit strings scattered throughout this input-output space. Well, it's actually the same space for the input as the output. And now I get my particular input. And Alice will simulate the channel, and rather the Homer Simpson way of doing it. But then she'll get some output, which typically is not in this green set. So she'll say, I'm supposed to send Bob this, but would require too much communication to explain to him about that string. I'll send him a different one, which is just as far away from my input as this one was. So, since this set of green dots was chosen randomly, this is going to be a fair transition probability. And the only time it fails is when there is a very small, when the channel introduced so little noise that there is no member of this green set that's near enough to be as near as I wanted. So, however, that doesn't happen very often. And if I want the channel simulation to be perfectly accurate, I just switch over to a different protocol, which is exactly sending the provisional output y instead of y prime. And that happens so rarely that it doesn't affect the average cost. So this is how we can say in the large M limit, if I want to send M bits through a noisy channel, I can do it by sending MC noiseless bits, which I choose with the help of the input. And then the remaining bits I don't have to take from the input or the channel simulation process at all. I just use them as extrinsic random bits, which I've agreed beforehand. This terminology of intrinsic and extrinsic was introduced by Andreas Winter, and is a very helpful, I found it very helpful in thinking about this. So the idea is to split this channel simulation into some stuff as little as possible that depends on the input, and then allow the rest of it, the randomness, to come from an extrinsic source that doesn't is independent of the input. Now, this has all been classical so far, but a similar situation exists with POVMs, and I can think of the POVM as a QC, or quantum classical channel. That is a channel with a quantum input and a classical output. And so I'm going to think about some really simple ones. We're going to imagine the inputs are going to be uniformly distributed on the surface of the Bloch sphere. And one example of a QC channel, or of a generalized measurement, is something that takes the input state and maps it into one of four different classical outputs. And the outputs are the elements of these the positive operators that add up to the identity in this case are just four different projectors onto the BB84 states. So this is four states disposed on the equator of the Bloch sphere at equal separations. And so this is something you can certainly simulate this channel by taking your input, performing that POVM, and then sending the number 0 through 3 to Bob. But that's a rather Homer Simpson way of doing it. you'd like to be able to send as little classical information as possible and still simulate the channel. And you can do that by deciding beforehand between Bob and Alice randomly whether you're going to measure in the x basis or the y basis. And then do this measurement, which is now not a POVM but a von Neumann measurement. You've done a random one of these two von Neumann measurements, and then you tell Bob the outcome of it, and Bob already knows whether that's the outcome of an x measurement or a y measurement, so you get a perfect simulation of the channel with less forward classical communication. So that's a case where it works very well, but there are other cases where it doesn't work very well. And an interesting one of those is where we have, instead of four states, we have three at equal angles on the equator. And now we have the problem that, of course, you can do it the Homer-Simpson way, and that is sending a three-state measurement after you've simulated the POVM in your own lab, but that's a little wasteful. And on the other hand, you cannot exactly express this three-way POVM as a mixture of any two outcome measurements. You might say, well, why don't I express it as a mixture of these two, and these two? But I cannot simulate that channel by deciding a priori that it's going to be one of these two, because it might not. So there's no way to do this exactly, but asymptotically it can be done in the limit of a large block size by essentially choosing a POVM that has about 2 to the L random outcomes from amongst these 3 to the L, and that's the choice of those. What that set of outcomes is the random information shared, and then these POVMs, although it's not so easy to show it, will be almost, that information will be almost extrinsic. And so on a large block, you will be able to simulate the input-output statistics of these trine measurements by about this much pre-agreed random information and only one bit of classical communication per measurement. And you might think of that as the dual to the fact that if you're going to try to use these trine states in a CQ channel, that is, you receive classical information from a three-state alphabet, and you prepare quantum states, and then you try at the receiving end to get as much information through as possible, the capacity of that is, the asymptotic capacity is one bit per channel use, although you can't achieve that capacity without block coding. Now, this trine example that I gave is an application of this powerful theorem that Winter proved in this recent paper, which is powerfully difficult even to express the statement of the theorem, and the proof is in some ways intuitive, but in some other ways, most of the intuition is what I already gave you, and I'm still trying to understand the details of it. But there it is. If anybody has a photographic memory, you'll be on a long plane ride. Shore recently used this to show with Winter that the quantum reverse Shannon theorem holds for general quantum channels if the source is fixed, that is, if all of the states are drawn from a fixed distribution on the input space. Oh, I think this is, how much am I missing? Oh, you know, there's a trick. There's a real, watch this. This is using PowerPoint in a way that it's not not intended to be used. There. No need to reboot the computer. There. So now we just look at the middle part. And the way we do it is to, you want to simulate this general noisy channel using shared entanglement and as little classical communication as possible. So we'll let this this noisy channel be defined by these Krauss operators, and what we do is we begin by a kind of generalized teleportation in which Alice performs a measurement in which she finds out which of these Krauss operators happened, and also which of the set of Pauli operators that would be applying to the output space of the channel, which of those has happened. Because, of course, when you do a teleportation, one of those things happens when you do the Bell measurement. Then she tells Bob only which Pauli operator happened. She doesn't tell him which noise operator happened. He undoes the Pauli and is left with the output that he wanted. Now, the trouble with that is that it uses too much classical communication. It's really the Homer Simpson way of doing it. You're simulating the channel at the starting end, and you're just using the full the full cost of teleporting accurately in the output space. So what Peter then does is just to use Winder's theorem and to simulate this generalized teleportation that Alice would have done by an approximate POVM that does the right thing. And when you work out the cost, the intrinsic cost of that, it turns out to be just the entanglement-assisted capacity of the channel. So this is how the general outline of how that's proved. Oh, it doesn't work here. You have to do something else here and get to the next page. Yeah. Oh, page down works. That's great. Okay, so this is a picture of what happens. We've got, we would have done a kind of generalized Bell measurement followed by teleportation of the output. But in fact, what we do is I haven't gotten Andreas's permission for using this word, winterized for poor version of the generalized measurement. And because it's winterized, it can use less classical communication, but it needs some shared randomness. So we've got two of these distributed resources. We've got entanglement that we need for the teleportation, and we have shared randomness that we need for the winterization, but you can make that from more entanglement. So it's just really, in a world with free entanglement, these things are negligible costs. Oh, that's perfect. Okay, so now that's the end of that story. I want to say something about teleportation versus remote state preparation. Now, as everybody knows, in teleportation, you start with a single specimen of the input, and you get a single specimen of the output, and you use two classical bits per qubit. And it's very clean, and you might say oblivious, in the sense that Alice doesn't need to know anything more about this state, and if she tried to learn anything more, she'd spoil it. Than just having a single copy of it. And Bob gets only a single copy, and he can't learn anything more about it. So this is can be summarized by saying this teleportation is oblivious for both the sender and the receiver. Now, we've come up about a year ago with some, or 2 years ago, with some improvements on this efficiency, where we can get an asymptotic cost of 1 bit instead of 2 bits when we know the state classically going in. And as it turns out in all of the known protocols, when there's some extra information that leaks out to Bob. So these are rather complicated protocols. They work on large block sizes. There's various other communication. But the end result is that it takes classical knowledge on the input, and it doesn't leave Bob with just a single specimen of the output. It leaves some other junk left over, like failed EPR pairs, from which if he were very inquisitive, he could find additional information about the state that you're trying to transmit. So this is oblivious for neither party. And the new result that I want to mention, without saying how to prove it, is is this one, that is, if a remote preparation protocol that is using shared entanglement of forward communication only, no back communication, if it is exact and oblivious for Bob, then it must be oblivious for Alice. Now, what I mean by that is that even if Alice had classical information about the state, she couldn't use it. Her actions in performing this remote state preparation that's oblivious for Bob's point of view can be entirely simulated by a POVM which takes the unknown state as a quantum input rather than as classical information, parameterizing the POVM. So it's an unparameterized POVM taking an additional quantum input, which is the state you're trying to send. Therefore, if the remote state preparation protocol leaks no information to Bob, then it must be essentially teleportation, and it must cost 2 bits of classical information per qubit remotely prepared. And I thought this was one of the most exciting results because it explains something I've always noticed in political speeches, which is that if a politician is trying to make a speech that avoids conveying unwanted information, generally it makes the speech longer. So it's, you know, it's like you're promising tax breaks to, if you just promise them to the farmers and you don't promise it to the factory workers or to the professors, then you're going to have real trouble. But if you promise a tax break to everybody, then you've essentially said nothing, but it's a longer speech. So in the future, these are things that we might work on with this, or problems that I hope to be solved. That is, finishing the proof of the quantum reverse Shannon theorem, applying it to other problems in channel capacity and remote preparation. I think we might hear a little bit about that from Richard later on today. And there's the problem, another conjecture about remote state preparation, which is that even if it allows to leak extra information to Bob, we know no cases in which, although the average, I should say these grow out of a conjecture of Hoi Quang Lo, which really started this whole remote state preparation business, which was that if you can do remote state preparation, it always costs as much as classical communication as teleportation. We found that it costs less on average, but you have to leak extra information, and it sometimes costs more. So the other part of this conjecture is to show that if the worst case performance, that the worst case performance of remote state preparation is as costly as teleportation. That's a conjecture that still remains to either be proved or refuted. Now, I'm really towards the end, and I think it's a time to talk about some fun stuff that I did with Ben Schumacher. I hesitate to call it work. And I was even a little ashamed to talk about it until Bill Buters put me up to it. In other words, in various science fiction magazines, you can read about time travel. And so naturally, you might wonder what would happen if you had a unitary interaction between two qubits, well, which were not two qubits, but which were the same qubit at two different times. So another way of looking at that is to say, well, we take the qubit, and it goes to the unitary interaction, and then it goes backwards in time, and it provides the other input to the unitary interaction. What if anything, does this mean, and what can you say about it? Of course, we should be aware of these grandfather paradoxes, where this interaction is the sort of thing that couldn't have happened, or at least excludes certain combination of initial state and presumed interaction. Now, in fact, without anything exotic at all, no wormholes or anything, just purely ordinary quantum information theory, you can simulate this time travel. And the way you do it is you take your input and you run it through the gate, and you take an EPR pair and run one of the things through the gate. And then you take the input that has come out of the gate and its other member of the EPR pair, and you ask if they're in the same state that you prepared them in. And if they were, then you can regard this leg of the EPR pair as a trip backward in time. And so this whole circuit is a circuit of the kind that I drew, but without anything exotic in it. And the penalty you pay for that is that this Bell measurement doesn't always succeed. And so the physical process that's going on in the laboratory is quite mundane. Preparation of an entangled pair, executing a gate, doing a measurement. And you only say that some of the outcomes of the measurement correspond to meaningful things, and the others you just dismiss and throw away. Now, the nice thing about this is that if you can work out the quantum circuit, and it's quite clear what comes out here, so you have some kind of prediction of what would have happened if there were time travel. So here's an example of that. Let's this be a controlled NOT gate here. And we send in a zero, it goes through here, and this is the state of all three bits. We've done this gate, and we sort of conditionally flip the last two. And then we come here, and we do the Bell measurement, and it turns out here it succeeds half the time. And so in the cases that it succeeds, the output here comes out in the pure state, which is the superposition of zero and one. So now that's, what if anything does that say that's more than what you could say classically? Well, it says a little bit more, I think. Because let's think of this simulation of time travel in a classical way, which you can do in the same way by this post-selection. Post-selection is such a powerful tool that it can destroy any sort of magic. And so here you do the same thing. You say you have your input here, and at this point, we just guess the value of the bit that's going to be our time-traveled self. No one can prevent us from guessing, so we do that. We do the interaction, and then we get some output state, which could be one or the other, depending on how our guess was. And then we back here, we ask if our guess was correct. That's certainly legitimate to do. And we get a kind of post-selection that says, ignore the whole thing unless our guess of what the output state of bit number two, which is the input state of bit number three, if that guess is correct, then we keep it, otherwise we throw it away. But here there's a big difference. We get out a mixed state. We get equiprobably zero or one, whereas in the quantum case we got a superposition. And I would like to have anybody who knows more about quantum cosmology say whether this difference between being able to get a mixed state and a superposition is meaningful. And this is the other features of this we found are that we can produce any output state by doing this kind of time travel on one leg of an EPR pair. So in a sense, we can change the partial trace of the other side by doing this selection. Well, that's hardly surprising because we're throwing it away some of the time. So that's not especially exciting. And then there's this case where this one, there's a bit that just lives inside the apparatus, goes around forever and never comes out. And the post-selection always works. And then finally we get the grandfather paradox, which is the same gate except we put a one in, and then the post-selection always fails. So the questions that one can ask about this are, is it time travel? And I think the better answer to that is no. It doesn't really involve any cloning because these two bits are not in, the two copies of the bit are not independent. And well, you can read that. So I think that's a good place to stop and ask for questions.
What happens if you get a different
I think not. I think that, in other words, it either succeeds or fails. There is something that I didn't mention here. Remember, if I put a zero in, I get the superposition of zero and one. If I put a one in, I get a grandfather paradox and nothing ever comes out. If I put a superposition of zero and one in, I always get zero plus one out, and the only thing that changes is the success probability. Yes, yes. That's right.
Could you say a few more words, and maybe Debbie could say a few more words, going back to your earlier slides about this idea of the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic data? You have this horrendous theorem, or what you call linearization, some of the intuition behind that.
Well, the goal, you could say, is always to do something like this. We want to simulate a channel of some sort, or simulate a POVM, which is a kind of channel, and we want to do it with the least classical communication from the input area to the output area. And so that involves some choice of operator here, or block coding and some operator here, and we wanted to do that in such a way as to minimize the width of this leg here. That's what they call the intrinsic information. And then these other resources, which classically could just be information, and quantum mechanically but would be entanglement and shared information, are allowed to get as big as you want. So at least that's the definition of the problem. I think any time you come even close to doing time travel, except with some kind of black holes or wormholes or something that I don't understand, it will involve this post-selection, in which you cannot control something that you're... There will be some measurement in there whose outcome you can't control. And if you insist that it have a particular outcome, which it might not have, then you can interpret it as time travel. But that's the fact you cannot control that outcome is preventing you from regarding any of these mundane experiments as real time travel.
Yes? For those of us without a photographic memory, could you put up your compressed version of Fisher's POVM?
Yes. There.
Could you try to...
All right, let's see what this says. That's what you wanted.
Could you try to say in words, intuitively, what the idea of this content of this theorem is?
Okay, what you have here, you have some given density matrix that you're operating on, and you have a POVM that operates on one copy of that Hilbert space. And with that, you can define these output probabilities of the different outcomes of the measurement. And it's convenient to define this sort of square root ensemble, which Winter calls the canonical ensemble, not to be confused with a thing of the same name in statistical physics, which is it depends on both this measure, this POVM, and the density matrix. You take the square root of the density matrix before and after, and we get a new, a set of states which add up to the original row. Then the idea is that for any tolerance, epsilon, there's a sufficiently large block size, and a new POVM, which I use big B for. It's big B because it operates on the block. And it's supposed to be a good approximation to L parallel copies of the A. Now, this B is the thing that separates the extrinsic from the intrinsic information. It is expressible as a mixture, a convex mixture, where these x sub nu's are probabilities. So this says, in order to realize B, I pick B super nu randomly and independently of the input. I just choose one of those things to do. That's the extrinsic information. And then the fact that each of these B's has a rather small number of outcomes is the intrinsic information that we're trying to minimize. And he shows that that the size of this intrinsic information is about, of course, proportional to the block size multiplied by the entropy of the output. Well, this is just the whole of information of the of this canonical ensemble. And so then the next thing you have to say, well, it's in what sense is this approximation good? And it can be done in terms of a trace norm of the difference of the operators, or you can say also that if you chose any other ensemble realizing rho to tensor power L, then summing over all the inputs and outputs, the difference between the actual and the simulated POVM probabilities would be less than epsilon.
Probably go on. Thank you, speaker. It really gives us something to chew on the plane.